try that on.
Testing 1, 2, 3, 4. Testing 1, 2, 3, 4. This is the Royal Astronomical Society.
Now we will observe the spectrum of this star
as seen through this gas. And we'll only worry about one spectral line. And if we plot the intensity of light against the wavelength, normally, with no gas in here, we assume that we're just going to have a continuum. Now we put in some number of atoms like this, and there are many variables if you want to go into more detail, but I won't worry about them today. And we will get an absorption line. That is, some of the light emitted by this star is absorbed by the intervening gas. Now, on the other hand, suppose these atoms we put in 10 to the 12th molecules. Well, as we see before, these molecules give bands, each of which is composed of a very large number of lines. And the sum total of the intensity of a great number of these lines, one whole band system, has the same strength as roughly one atomic line. So if we put in 10 to the 12th molecules in here, they're funny looking things, we will get this same intensity of absorption spread over perhaps 100, perhaps 10,000 lines. The result is we'll see nothing, because all of them will be too weak. So in general, it is much harder to detect a small quantity of molecules than atoms. However, suppose on the other hand, we have a high density of gas here. We have many atoms. Instead of 10 to the 12th, we have 10 to the 22nd. That is, what is it, 10,000, maybe more, 10 to the 10th more. But then, of course, this atomic line, which started out like this, will now become very strong. It will become a line which will come down, like so. And it will be quite broad and very strong. But, in point of fact, its width here will not be very great. It depends upon a great number of factors, but it might be only, say, of the order of 10 angstroms. So. And so, in spite of the fact we have 10 to the 10th times more molecules than are needed for detection, we haven't lost very much of our original light. That is, we've only lost about 10 angstroms. Now suppose, on the other hand, we put 10 to the 22nd molecules. Now we would really have to change the scale to show this effect. But originally, with this small number of molecules, we had a lot of little absorption lines here. So small we couldn't detect them. Now each one of them grows 10 to the 10th times stronger. They just go over and they absorb practically anything. So molecule everything. So molecules are rather hard to detect, but once you get a lot of them, they take over and absorb practically everything. So this is, of course, another reason why they're considered very much of a nuisance, not very useful for astronomers, because if you have a large molecular absorption, you can see nothing else. Now, where are we going to see molecules? What sort of regions, or where in astrophysics are we likely to find molecules? Well, we say at once, they must be in regions where the temperature is quite low. How low depends upon a great number of factors, but things that favor molecules in its formation are low temperature, and in general, high pressure. So you can compensate a very great change in pressure by a small change in temperature. So we can say at once that on the bright stars, the very hot stars, where molecules are going to play no part, because this is the dominant factor in determining dissociation of molecules. And this brings in another factor. Suppose we have the Earth here, and within a certain cone, a certain angle out here, we're going to put over various distances 100 bright stars. All the temperatures are greater than 10,000 degrees. And we also put over here, spread around this region, 100 faint stars, 100 stars, the temperatures less than 2,000 degrees. Now, on some night, up the observatory here, Dr. Hogg looks out this direction, and and sees, aha, I can see all these stars. I can see about nearly 100 stars here of this type because they're all very bright. These ones, however, she only sees a few of them because these are the faint stars. The temperature is low, and furthermore, if you're photographing it, the intensity is all in the infrared, which is quite a nuisance to photograph. And so these type of stars, low temperature stars, are much harder to see. And these are the ones in which molecules will play a large part. These ones are so hot in temperature that all the atom molecules are dissociated into atoms. And thus we find another reason why molecules will play not a very large part in many observations. In fact, they're very much underrated from their actual importance. There's a third effect, which is not an astronomical effect, but I think it's an astronomer's effect. Every astronomer, when taking his course in university and preparing for work, takes a good stiff course in atomic spectra, figures out F values, curves of growth, and so forth. And I think just the day before they graduate, the professor says, oh yes, there are things called molecules too, and they're quite a nuisance because they get in the way of atomic observations. So when he goes out and he sees a spectrum which has some atomic lines on it and some great bands, he says, ah, these are the things I know what to play with, how to handle, I know how to play with these. These are quite a nuisance, so I'll overlook these and I'll write about these ones. And so the literature then gets more full than it needs to be of atomic spectra. And so the new astronomers coming along say there's no need to know anything about molecules because nobody writes of them. We've gone the full circle. I don't pretend that molecular spectra will ever be as important as atomic spectra, but I think there is a sort of a psychological effect in favor of the atoms. Well, having just about driven molecules out of existence and said they're not true of any, they don't play much of a part, let's consider where they do exist and where they are important. Well, the first thing we can say is they are important in the atmospheres of the planets. I think our own air is quite an important factor. And the study of the atmospheres of other planets has been carried out through observation of molecular spectra. Another place is in the atmosphere of the comets. Now, if you look at the next two slides, this is just a picture of a comet. You can see it, it's very bright. The photographer put a lot of contrast into it, so it's very bright. But let's look at the next slide, which shows the spectrum of the same thing. And when you look at the spectrum, you see you have not atomic lines, and I should say that these are many spectra. Just consider one line across here. This is the spectrum. And you see that these are not the atomic lines. They're all molecular bands. And if there were no molecular bands there, there wouldn't be much light in that comet at all. Just some rather dull, scattered light. Dull in two respects. First, there wouldn't be much of it. And when you observed it, you tried to examine it, all you would see is the scattered light of the sun, not modified at all, and it wouldn't give you much information. So there's another place where a molecular spectrum will play some part. The next slide will show another place. This is a spectrum taken at Mount Wilson, which just shows the spectrum of a distant star with 1, 2, 3 sharp absorption lines in it. These are lines absorbed by molecules in interstellar space. These two observed by CH molecule, this by CN. And finally, the last slide. This is a spectrum of a star, and this one here, won't worry about the rest of it. But here you see one of these bands in reverse in absorption. Here, another one here, the density gone down. So in all the cooler stars, you will find molecular bands in its absorption. So the molecules do play some part. Well, what molecules are we likely to observe? Well, we can say at once that only the molecules which are of high stability will be observed. You can think of a molecule such as sodium molecule, sodium-2, which you can produce in the lab very easily. It's not likely to be observed in any astronomical body, because it's very easily photodissociated, it's very easily thermally dissociated. The two sodium atoms don't want to stick together. So only the very stable molecules will be observed. Also, they will be the small molecules, because the larger molecules take a lot of building. We take a molecule such as benzene, we have to put a lot of atoms together the right way, and most regions of space are very chaotic, tending to break such things down. So we will only observe very simple molecules. Thirdly, we will only observe those molecules for which their abundances are reasonable. At the present time in our lab, we're looking at the spectrum of pH, phosphorus chloride. It has a very pretty spectrum, a good region for astronomical observation. It will never be observed in the atmosphere of a star because phosphorus is very rare, chlorine is very rare. The chances of the two of them coming together and forming a molecule are so remote, we need to worry about it. And then finally, we have to worry, as we do with atoms, about the spectral region. That is, one of the most stable molecules and simple molecules, and certainly the highest binding energy, is the nitrogen molecule. But we can't observe it. It has no absorption bands until we get far, far in the back from ultraviolet. And to get emission from it, even that requires a very high excitation. So you will very, very seldom see the spectrum of nitrogen, even though there might be a great deal of it around. And finally, we might say, well, if we do observe molecular spectra, what information can it give? Well, it turns out that molecular spectra is rather a fine tool. If you have a region in space where you have some combination of atoms, molecules of various elements, all, say, an atmosphere of a star, you have cooked this stew of atoms up to a fairly high temperature, and you want to know what here's the bright source behind here, and you're looking at it from this side, and you want to know what the spectrum would look like. So you produce some sort of a model for this. This keeps the sort of work that keeps many astronomers busy for a long while. And you can produce a fairly crude model, which might give the atomic spectra, which are fairly close to those that are observed. It might give atomic spectrum very close to the observed atoms. But if you have molecules in here, and you want to account for those quantitatively, you have to be much more careful. It is a rather too fine a tool, because until you know in a great detail a lot, both about molecules and the abundances of elements in here, and the temperature and the pressure, you cannot get the right answer for the appearance of your molecular spectra. And this, of course, is one of its drawbacks and might eventually be its greatest success. It does demand very exact models of what is happening in order to get the right answer. But when, now, we say this molecular spectra depend upon various factors. The first one is temperature, and certainly the most important one. And so, conversely, molecular spectra can be used to measure temperature. It is difficult in many respects, but for low temperature sources, it might be far the best one that's known. It's been used to measure the temperature of the upper atmosphere, a synthetic temperature, since there's no real temperature in comets, and it has been used to measure the temperature of gases, atmospheres of stars. Pressures, I won't say anything about, it gets very complicated. The abundances of elements, it has also been used in measurements of abundances, but there again, you have to go through a very long procedure to get the answer of it. I mean, you cannot look at a volume in space and say, I see a lot of CH coming up a spectrum, and say, well, this depends only upon the concentration of carbon, hydrogen, and the temperature. Because if you happen to have a lot of oxygen there, it will tie up all the carbon in carbon monoxide, and you won't see this, even though there's lots of carbon and a lot of hydrogen there. And there are many factors. You go through a long chain of calculation in order to find out whether this spectrum should, how this depends upon the abundances of carbon and abundances of hydrogen. It will give you the right answer if you know it. Finally, there is something which Dr. McKellar did and will prove, I think, very important, has proven important, and you can do with molecular spectra and you cannot do with atomic spectra. And that is to find the relative abundances of isotopes. If you consider the two carbon isotopes, carbon of mass 12 and carbon of mass 13, their atomic spectra are so closely the same that certainly you will not be able to tell the difference by any observation of a stellar source. However, if you do look at the C2 bands, you can tell the difference between the C2-12 band and the C13-C12 band. This molecule, combined where you have two isotopes, it has molecular spectra that are considerably shifted with respect to those of the C12, and therefore you can use it to determine the relative abundances, say, of the C12 and C13 isotopes. And Dr. McKellar did this many years ago and was the first to point out that in certain stars, carbon-13 isotope is much more abundant than it is on this Earth. Well, in all this work, you need to know have a lot of information about your molecule before you can do any astrophysical work. And this is the type of thing which we have been interested in our laboratory. Now, the first thing you have to do, of course, and most obviously, you have to excite the spectrum of a molecule and just find out where that spectrum is, so that if you see a comparable same one in the star, you'll identify it. That is the simple matter of trying to reproduce in the laboratory the same band systems as you see in stars. Much more than that, if you want to do any calculations, you have to know in detail many molecular constants. You need to know the vibration frequency of the two nuclei, if you consider diatomic constants. You need to know the energy, to pull the two atoms apart, dissociation energy. You need to know what we call the V value, or the distance between the two nuclei in the molecule. How big is the molecule? These are the sort of things that you can get out of laboratory observations. And these are the things we have been trying to do. Finally, there is one thing which is very necessary, and very little has been done about it. That is the determination of what we call the F value, or which is a measure of the, say, for this present purposes, the strength of absorption of this of a molecule. I thought I would give you two examples of the type of work we have been doing in order that you might see something of the type of work that needs to be done. These are not particularly the most important type of particular examples, but they're things I'm familiar with, and it's always easier to speak about those than something you read about in the textbook. A few years ago, Dr. Clayman came to us from Sweden as a postdoctoral fellow, and he wanted to carry on some work on diatomic molecules. Well, it turned out, that there is something which was interesting to him and also interesting to us, and that was this problem. The diatomic molecule C2 is well known. And I should have perhaps pointed out that the molecules we are dealing with here are not the things you're going to find on this Earth necessarily as a perfectly stable chemical compound. That is, you have to consider the difference between what you might call chemical stability and physical stability. If you take a molecule such as, say, CH, carbon and hydrogen atom, use it and throw it into an infinite vacuum, it will last there quite happily, and there's no tendency to dissociate. However, if you try to get a bottle full of this, of course, as soon as two of these hit each other, they'll combine and form some larger molecule. And so you cannot get any concentration of them. But in regions of high temperature, you may get these, or in regions where you get very few collisions, you may get these molecules. And these are the sort of things that are often important from the point of view of astrophysics, but you're not going to go to the chemistry stores and ask for a bottle. But one of the molecules which is very well known is the C2 molecule. If you have a Bunsen flame, the inner cone is green. The inner cone is green because of the emission of the C2 molecules. Another molecule which is known rather less well is the silicon molecule. This molecule, C2, occurs also in many astrophysical sources. This one, as far as I know, doesn't occur in any, but it may be found later because silicon is relatively abundant. The cross product, SiC, should be a perfectly good stable molecule. It should be in abundance somewhere halfway between these two. Nobody has found the spectrum of SiC. So when Dr. Clayton came, we sent him to work to try and find the spectrum. Actually, what we did was to take a carbon tube and you put a couple of electrodes on it and you pass about 2,000 or 3,000 amperes through it, and the temperature you can reach in such a tube is, say, 3,000 degrees. And of course, it has to be put in a vacuum so it doesn't burn out. So if you do that and look in the end of this carbon tube, you will see the emission of the C2 gas. That is, some of the carbon evaporates, and in the middle here you see a nice glow of the hot gas. It seemed only reasonable that if we put a little silicon in here, that it would also evaporate, and at the high temperature it mixed up with the carbon, we should get these SiC bands. And this is what Dr. Taylor did. Well, it turned out that when the temperature of this tube got up to about 2300 degrees centigrade, and this is a very low temperature for this sort of furnace, but still 700 degrees above the melting point of iron, found the emission, quite a bright spectrum. There was nothing very subtle about it. You could take a little pocket spectrograph and spectroscope and look through it into this tube, and you could see the pretty spectrum, because it's right in the vessel. And he looked at this in more detail with a big spectrograph and found it was a very complicated spectrum. It, unfortunately, as he thought at first, didn't look at all like what you would expect for SiC, because a diatomic molecule should have a reasonably simple spectrum. This was extremely complex. About this time, we remembered that long ago, Merrill, and more recently Sanford, had examined the spectra of certain stars and had found in them emission absorption bands which had not been identified. These had also been discussed by Dr. McKellar. In fact, it was hard to find any astronomical data on molecular spectra which had not been discussed and treated very thoroughly by Dr. McKellar. But at that time, he was unable to identify the source of these bands. When we compared these emission bands with those that had been found by Sanford and Merrill, we did in fact find that they were identical. And if I may have that last slide you put on, not the new one, the last one you put on, you will see this is the spectrum I showed, a stellar spectrum before with an absorption band here and another very strong absorption band here. In the furnace, we got these bands in absorption emission. It doesn't matter, you can't get them in absorption. That's just a matter of experimental setup. Here comes the one band that we got in our lab. Here's another one. Here's the band in the lab, exactly duplicating that. There are some weaker ones here in absorption. They were marked by the astronomers. And here's the emission in the lab. So there was no doubt that we had in the laboratory exactly the same spectrum that occurred in these stars. Now, it didn't really solve the problem entirely, because we didn't know yet what we had in the lab. We did know a great deal more about it, though, because it seemed fairly obvious that silicon had to be present. There seemed to be nothing else other than silicon and carbon present. We kept adding a little bit of this and a little bit of the other thing to see if we could affect the bands. But silicon and carbon seemed to be all that was necessary. Furthermore, they didn't seem to be bands of diatomic molecules. They're much too complicated for that. We could do a partial analysis of the band, and it appeared very good evidence that these were bands of a triatomic molecule, SICC. Silicon, with two carbon atoms attached to it, a linear molecule. The evidence we have in the lab that this is the molecule cutting we have found seems to be fairly good, but not 100%. And this was the way it was left by Clayman about 5 years ago. And this, unfortunately, is the way it's remained ever since. Because if we want to find something more about this molecule, we will have to produce it and make it, force it somehow to emit its spectrum at a lower temperature. When it gets to a higher temperature, there are various technical reasons that become very complicated and we can't untangle it. If we could force this thing to produce, to emit its spectrum, say from a discharge tube or something like that, room temperature, we'd be able to do something about it. Well, I've wasted some months looking for it, low temperature, but I haven't found it. But I think we have got somewhere on this path to unraveling the central marrow bands. Now I'll move on to a totally different example. I showed an earlier slide in which we had the absorption spectrum of interstellar lines. Now, what was found shortly after the turn of the century? That with certain stars, you're observing them from the Earth, you find that the spectrum of the atmosphere of the star must undergo certain changes due to the double stars or different velocities here. You found in the absorption spectrum certain lines which did not partake of any of the motions of the atmosphere of this star. And it was finally concluded, and very conclusively proven, that these lines arose from absorptions of atoms in interstellar space. Now, the density of atoms here is very low, but still sufficient to give you these sharp interstellar absorption lines. Now, it was finally found that calcium, iron, sodium, potassium, and iron, I think, titanium. And there must be many others, but the lines are not in the right spectral region, so you can't find them. But these are the reasonably abundant elements which have lines in the region which we can observe, and all of these were found in interstellar space. However, besides these, there were a number of other lines which could not be identified with the spectra of any known atom. Swings, I think, first suggested, and later, Dr. McKellar gave very definite proof that these were due to the CN and to the CH molecules. It turns out, under the conditions that exist in interstellar space, which are very cold, the whole band system of a molecule, these very large number of lines in a band, all come down to a single line, or at most two lines. And Dr. McKellar, when one or two lines of CN be found, he predicted that, said, if this is CN, then you should find this other line, this other line, and this other line. And Dr. Adams and Melvin Wilson took some spectra, and he found them just where Dr. McKellar had said they should be. So there's very good proof that CN and CH were important. There were, however, four other lines which were observed, which were not identified. And these were, I'll write down the number just for you. This is the wavelengths. We won't have to worry very much about these in detail. And these were quite strong lines. Behaved himself perfectly well at these weights. Now, Dr. McKellar looked at these and said, well, they all appear to be related, and it's probable that they belong to one molecule, which we don't know what it is, which hasn't been found in the lab yet. Furthermore, he said if they belong to a molecule, they belong to a molecule that contains hydrogen. It's a diatomic molecule containing hydrogen. And this is the way the situation rested, about 1940. About 1941, there was a conference at Yerkes Observatory, and Dr. Hertzberg attended this, and of course he had just finished writing a nice book on diatomic molecules, and he, along with Teller, looked at these same things and came to much the same conclusion. But he also carried it one step further and said, it's very probable that it's the CH plus molecule that gives these lines. Well, it just happened at that time I'd been in the United States, and it was obvious you couldn't carry on much further because of the war in academic work, and I came back to Saskatchewan to work with Dr. Hertzberg for a few months until I found out what else I was going to do. And he had said, well, we'll come back to work on the B2 molecule, but just as I got there, he came back very excited from Yerkes and said, I think we should look for this thing. So we did. And I was just the hands, and he supplied the intelligence. But we found what we did was make something like an ordinary neon tube, a tube with a couple of electrodes in it. And we put a high voltage across this. And from this discharge tube, we passed a helium with a trace of benzene, and it threw this. And within 1 week from the time we started, we found a set of bands which looked like the bands of CH plus, and after another few weeks we managed to get them very high dispersion, analyze them, and found indeed we had the spectrum of CH plus. Furthermore, we found that this spectrum must did give these lines in exactly the wavelengths that were observed for the interstellar lines. So there is no doubt then we had identified the interstellar lines, at least three of them. Where this last one was, we found on our plate nothing but a great number of other bands, not related to CH, but related to C2, and they just blocked out this region, and we couldn't say anything about it. Furthermore, we could, from these three lines, extrapolate and say if there's a fourth line of this series, because these are related by certain ways I won't go into, we could predict where this fourth one should be. And when we did, we found it came at 3582 energy. Reasonably close, but still we could say that if the CH plus was a well-behaved molecule, if this line was indeed not the CH plus, all you can do is a sort of an extrapolation, there's no theory behind it. You have three lines, which you can click like that, you can draw a line and say, well, if they are the lines, the fourth one should occur here, and it occurred far enough off that we thought it really wasn't. And that's the way that it remains for about 17 or 18 years. But again, we rely on postdoctoral fellows, just as universities rely on graduate students. And Dr. Morton had been in our lab doing microwave spectroscopy. Well, this is obviously much newer than an ordinary optical spectroscopy, but he finished his microwave work and thought he would go slumming for a while and came out to us to do a little old-fashioned optical spectroscopy. So we started out and said, well, the thing to do was to look for the C2 plus molecule. This is a molecule that should exist, should give a perfectly good spectrum, but hasn't been found yet. Now, when he did searching for this, we went through very much the same procedure as we had in Saskatchewan, but we had a fancier types of discharge tubes and certain modifications I won't go into detail. And we hoped to find the C2 plus molecule. After about a month and a half, we had not found it, but we did find a CH plus molecule came up in emission very much stronger than we'd ever had in Saskatchewan. But having done that, we thought we could look for this But unfortunately, in the same region of the spectrum, we have the same color. It's overlapped. However, looking back here, we did find another band. And it turned out, from theory, it is another band such that you can, from this band, predict exactly and precisely where this one does exist. No theory, no doubt about it at all. This is shown on the next slide, just to show the nature of the things you eventually get out. But you see, the spectrum is this region through the middle. All this trellis work is something we put on to impress people. But you see, it's the spectrum of something like CH here is taken with very high dispersion, and it's a very open spectrum. So it doesn't look very much like a band spectrum at all. It almost looks like a common spectrum. Well, the Saskatchewan, we had found this band marked down below where you have this strong series. These lead lines certainly indicate some quantum numbers of these lines. What we found now was another series, which is perfectly well behaved, which comes in here, 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 here. From this, we predicted, thank you, where this line should be, and we didn't find it came exactly at 35.79. So our extrapolation, which we carried out about 18 years earlier, was something of this nature, that we had got 3 points here, 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 and we had predicted the fourth one to be here, and the observed one is actually somewhat off the line. Sort of proves you can't trust them all. And furthermore, we would go on one step further and predict the next one, and it's way off the line, it's way down here. And so CH plus, for reasons which are not called obvious, is not a well-behaved molecule. But nevertheless, we had picked up this last remaining interstellar line. But I just simply give those two examples, the sort of thing that must be done in the laboratory in order to make molecular spectra at all useful for astronomical purposes. Now, what future fields exist? I think there are two, one of which is fairly obviously going to happen, barring a major war, and the other may happen. First, what may happen? I think there's no doubt that the greatest advance in astronomy in recent years has been the introduction of radio astronomy. First, we had just the problem of finding general noise, picking up on radio frequencies. Then radio stars were found. But a great deal of the important work has been done with one line, the line due to the hydrogen atom at 21 centimeters. Because with a line, you can do many things that you cannot do looking at a continuum. If you have sort of a continuum you're looking at, where you're plotting here to be light cycles against intensity, you cannot do anything like measuring a Doppler effect. Nor can you get anything which you get from various broadenings on that. And you can get a great deal more information from an atomic line than you can from a general continuum. Unfortunately, this one line due to the hydrogen atom is the only one known. And there has been considerable effort spent trying to think of what else might be found. Well, the next most obvious one is a hydrogen isotope, generally with deuterium. Well, people have spent a long time looking for that. It has not been found. It turns out that most other atoms do not give lines in a suitable region, or there are many other reasons. The two most likely candidates are molecules. One is the OH molecule. Now it turns out we know pretty nearly precisely where to look for a microwave or a radio astronomy line, you might call it, of the OH molecule. It's at 1668 megaseconds. Because the laboratory microwave spectrum of OH has been found. In fact, some effort has been made to search for this, and it's been unsuccessful. The other candidate is CH. Now, we know CH occurs in interstellar regions because we have observed its optical spectrum. It will give a line somewhere around 3180 megacycles. This is not at all precisely known, because nobody has found the radio frequency spectrum of CH in the lab. It's a very hard thing to get any concentration, to get in any concentration in the laboratory, and nobody's got enough concentration of it to find its microwave spectrum. Now, I think perhaps this summer we will try. In fact, we get a much better measurement of this just by optical means. Because if we could find one more line suitable for radio astronomy, it would be extremely useful. And of course, to search for a line when you don't know where it's going to occur in space, and you don't know its frequency very well, you're fighting pretty hard back. So if you can get a lab grant for it, you will be much better off. So this is one thing we hope might happen, that somebody might find this. And it would open up a very considerable field. Finally, there's not much doubt that radio, that within the next few years, we're going to have satellite astronomy. That is, we're going to get rid of the effect of atmospheric absorption. We're going to carry out our spectrum much further into the violet and also into the red, because though the Earth's atmosphere cuts out very sharply and definitely in the violet, it also is a tremendous nuisance in the near infrared and cuts out completely further out. Now, in the violet, of course, you're getting essentially into higher energies, and you're getting into the domain of atomic spectrum more and more. You will, however, find certain molecular bands, and you might hope to find such things, which should exist, but have not been found in most sources, such as CO, N2, which are very stable molecules, and have no bands in the regions we can normally observe. As you go into the infrared, and I'm afraid this will come later, you will find many, many molecular bands. The difficulty probably will be you will find too many of them. Their intensity will be small. It will be a long, hard work to get them untangled. But I think eventually, because they do represent a rather fine tool for measuring what's going on, they will become extremely useful. Well, in all this work, I think it is fairly obvious that we must have a good deal of laboratory information before we can use the spectra we observe astronomically for any useful purpose. And this work is only being done very, very slowly. A few years ago, or perhaps I should say 20 years ago, this area is getting a little grayer now, molecular spectra used to be a very good, honorable profession for anybody studying physics. And spectra used to be taken, spectra of relatively simple molecules, those which are extremely necessary in the study of astronomy. However, changes have taken place in physics. Nuclear physics, solid state, plasma, and all the other fields of physics have come along, and spectroscopy has been forced out. It has been taken up again, largely by the chemists. But the chemists, for the most part, are interested in more complicated molecules. The spectrum of diethyl tri-something benzene is not going to help astrophysics. It's very necessary for chemistry, but it's not going to serve the problem here. So we have now the fact that we require a good deal of information about very simple molecules, And there exists nobody anywhere who is taking up this problem very seriously. There are small groups, but no major effort is being spent on it. Also, we have to face the fact that this work now requires rather complicated equipment and rather expensive equipment. See, 20 years, 30 years ago, the easy problems were done. We are left with the harder ones, the ones that require more complicated equipment. This equipment is available today, but there are not very many people interested in doing this kind of work. Well, perhaps at this time, the astronomers will have to take up the work themselves. Perhaps we will require that there shall be laboratories attached to observatories. And then astronomers who meet problems in their observations will actually be able to carry it directly to their laboratories, which are attached to the observatory. And I think this is the way the problem will eventually have to be tackled. And when this time comes, there is no doubt at all that we will miss more than ever people of the caliber of Andrew McKellar, who could work extremely well both in the observatory and in the laboratory. Thank you.
I think you will agree with me that we were very fortunate in having as our guest speaker Dr. Douglas, who has given such a fine memorial lecture in memory of our past president. I think he has very clearly explained the importance of the study of molecules in astronomy. He has opened a vista of future progress, and he has very clearly shown the important place that McKellar's name will always have in the basic researches in this subject. On behalf of the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada, and on behalf of all those present tonight, I would like to extend our sincere thanks to Dr. Douglas for his presentation this evening.